you for those who got here on time. To my right is a friend of mine, Dan Brock. When I thought of the history of bioethics, I thought of who's lived through all of it, and I could think of no one more. Now, Dan and I have known each other a long time, and he has been a major figure in bioethics, and I did ask him to talk about history, but knowing Dan, he'll spend more time talking about where we're going than where we've been, though I'm sure he'll give you a few words about where we've been. He is at the Division of Medical Ethics at Harvard, which he's built up over the years. He has worked on many, many different commissions and groups. Some of you have been reading a little bit of Dan in my History of Bioethics class. Certainly one of the foremost writers and authors on a variety of subjects and fields, including surrogate consent, issues around research ethics, and on and on. So it's really my pleasure to introduce one of the real giants of the field. I think we asked, I think this time
was bioethics then and now.
Bioethics then and now, I think, with his title. We'll see if he actually lives up to that. Floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, you'll see the first slide is a disclosure. Back when I was at NIH, we had to have the first slide had to say this is not the official view of NIH or the Public Health Service or anything. I got asked to do this talk, I think, last spring. And so when it's far off and somebody asks you to write, talk on something you don't know anything about, you think, well, so I said I would. I'm a philosopher, not an historian. The historical remarks I'll make, I think, are going to be pretty obvious to most all of you. But they, in any event, are based on my experience, not any historical research. And at least half the talk will, as Art said, look forward. So at least I won't make empirical mistakes there. I might make prognostic mistakes, but not empirical mistakes. I started working in bioethics in the mid-70s, and serendipitously, as I think anyone who started around that time, nobody got PhDs in bioethics. Nobody trained. It just happened that things. I was at Brown at that time, the philosophy department, and one thing led to another, and then I ended up being a bioethicist, I guess. when I came out of graduate school, the term bioethics had yet to be coined by anyone. I think that was 72 or something like that. So that's my disclosure. I'll talk a bit about the, one very broad cut at the development of bioethics. And then I'm going to spend a lot of time with number seven here, namely population level bioethics. I'll be trying to convince you that that's what you should do, the young people among you, at least. That's what you should do. And it's no accident. I guess your move
to a population.
Yeah, I know. I just wondered if it had been announced there.
Oh no, they know. They don't care.
Okay.
We do care.
So I'll divide this into seven different. It's not really periods, but seven different ways of looking at what was done. Pre-20th century, then. Where bioethics was mostly professional codes of conduct for physicians, then research and its various scandals, which led to a lot of responses, public debate over clinical issues, and then the fifth is what I've called structure and financing of the healthcare system. New technologies really play a role all through the history. People get fascinated by them. They think there's much more ethical import than in fact they usually have. And then what I've called population level bioethics. And that's the looking forward to what all of you will be doing in the future, I hope. So pre-20th century, as you know, history goes back at least two millennia. Hippocratic traditions. At least even at this time, it saw medicine as a profession, not just a trade. One of the things that professions claim is a right to set their own standards for performance in the profession, and not to be, ideally, it would be not to be evaluated by external organizations. The Hippocratic tradition includes moral limits that are still important. Confidentiality is perhaps the most obvious example. It also has pieces of the tradition that are controversial, like aid in dying. That's a tradition that, you know, continues to this day, obviously, in some to some degree or another. A lot of students who graduate from medical school take the Hippocratic Oath or some variation on it. At least some of the Hippocratic stuff is stuffed into what they, at Harvard, they write their own oath. So a second period, and this is probably the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, was concerned with limits on physicians' conduct as professionals. Now, that's not terribly different than the Hippocratic tradition, but it concerned stuff that nobody cares about or worries about much anymore, at least bioethicists don't. I have MS and a foot problem, so I'm trying to deal with the blood that's under my feet. So they worry about issues like fee splitting, like should physicians be able to advertise. They worried about the conduct of the practice and your relations with other professionals. There were some things that we do now recognize as part of bioethics. Again, confidentiality is one of the most obvious examples. Consent for treatment. The consent for treatment, particular surgery, goes back to the legal cases go back to the turn of the beginning of the 20th century. And it was only in the second half of the 20th century that the requirement... I'm falling apart up here. That the requirement... for consent became a requirement for informed consent. And in this period, there was, I think the requirements were shaped by professional norms, again, the claim to self-regulation. They were shaped by law, for example, the cases that began to come down, but as I say, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, and also by various external influences, even the effect of moral norms and debates on what physicians did. The third period I want to say something about is research and its scandals. This, again, is nothing new to any of you, I imagine. Nazi practices and research led to the Nuremberg Principles. Dan Bucher and I were in Nuremberg for a conference several years ago, and we went to the courthouse where the trials took place, and I got to sit in one of the chairs that the accused sat in. Dan took my picture and then altered it with guilt, a big sign that guilty. But this led to, I think, a clear right of society to judge the profession. There was no question about that after Nuremberg. It led to the centrality of individual consent. It led to the centrality of the notion that you couldn't use patients for the benefit of others without their consent. That's a non-utilitarian principle, a Kantian principle for those philosophers out here, if there are any. And then, of course, there were later scandals like Tuskegee and Willowbrook being two of the better known, where in the first, patients with syphilis were not treated when treatments became available and were not told they weren't being treated. And Willowbrook, where an institution where residents of the institution were deliberately infected to see how things played out. Those research scandals led to the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects, and they developed general standards for research, the so-called Belmont Principles. They also developed principles for special vulnerable groups like women, pregnant women, children, mentally ill prisoners. The bureaucracy which now regulates research and the so-called common rule. I think there's a lot less controversy now about research principles as they apply in this country. My sense is research ethics is not the primary area of my research, but my sense is that the most interesting issues now are international research, especially in developing countries. And this led to later commissions. My first tiptoe into Washington bureaucracy was I was on the staff of the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical Research. We spent the first day at the office learning how to say, memorizing the name of the commission. But that was, it seems to have stuck with me. I was told when I got there that I had to have a business card because everybody in Washington had a business card. So, and my job title was staff philosopher. So I went to some guy who printed up business cards, and it had the presidential seal on it, and staff philosopher. And he thought it was a joke card, and it may have been actually. But that commission was I think similar to later ones in that we did we produced about 10 book length reports, and they're not, I don't think of them as an embarrassment. I think they're fairly good. Some of the things we did were, we were just told to do it through the White House. It was a president's commission. And some of the projects that we undertook, we did it on our own because we thought it was important to do it. I think the most significant report that we did was deciding to forego life-sustaining treatment, and that grew out of hearings we had from the Definition of Death report, which was the first project and which we'd been told to do by the White House. That was the first project, and what we found in the hearings that we held with regard to that is that people were really much more interested in end-of-life decision-making than they were in the Definition of Death. I think that's perfectly reasonable on their part. The commissions, that commission and later commissions had a significant impact often. There was authority accorded to them. When I came back, I was at Brown University then. When I came back to Brown after being in Washington for that year, first time I went to a case conference over at Rhode Island Hospital, which was the main teaching hospital for Brown, the risk manager walked in with our report under his arm and said, "The President's Commission says it's okay, so it's okay." Now, philosophers don't like winning arguments that way. but nevertheless, I think there was significant authority accorded to these, in part because in this case and a number of others, we did topics that there was substantial uncertainty about what it was okay to do. We didn't deal with things where there was a pretty strong consensus about what to do. And at this point, this was 1982, what was okay to do with regard to decisions about life-sustaining treatment was not at all settled. I had physicians telling me once a week at least, well, it's not legal to stop life-sustaining treatment. Now, that was false then. But it was widely believed then, false now too, obviously. And then there was a lot of international input into these issues. The World Medical Association, CIOM is the Council for the International Organizations of Medical Science, WHO got into, UNESCO also got into the act on these. And the focus of these international organizations impact into bioethics has been, I think, on the research issues, especially since so much of the research has shifted to being done by not academic institutions but by for-profit companies that do that research and often do it in developing countries. The I think bioethics became most prominent when people started to experience either themselves as patients or as family members of patients, began to experience getting stuck on machines. New forms of treatment became available in the 60s and beyond, dialysis being one good example, respirators that could keep people alive, often in conditions in which they didn't want to be kept alive, transplantation again. These were all developments which I think fed the desire to patients and families to have control over what was happening to them. And the there was a period when authority was being questioned in general. Art and I both were graduate students at Columbia, but since I'm an old fellow, I started to say old fart, but an old fellow, I was there before Art. I was there in the 60s when they tore down the fence around the park and Mark Rudd took over things and so forth. And it was a general period of, that was a period of the Vietnam War. There was a general questioning of authority and a rise of assertions of autonomy, and it got the healthcare sector and medical care, just like it got other areas. This control then of your decisions about your own care got extended to families of incompetent patients. The Quinlan case was in 1976. That was the first well-known case. She was on the cover of Time magazine, so it was an issue that captured public interest. Cruzan was about 15 years later, and then Terry Schiavo came along. Unfortunately, we had a head of the Senate then who was a doctor and pronounced what should be done, although he never saw the patient. This led to the development of ethics committees. When I first started in working in bioethics, hospitals did not have that bioethics. They did not have ethics committees. And those ethics committees were set up really to deal with these clinical dilemmas, clinical conflicts. They still do, as far as I can see, and the ones that I have contact with still get clinical cases, and often still, despite all the lot of us have written on them and so forth, still often end-of-life cases of one sort or another. Later, into the 80s, there began to be more focus on the structure and financing of the healthcare system. There was a growing awareness of insurance gaps. One of the reports we did on the commission that I was on, 81-82, was a report on it was called Securing Access to Healthcare. One of the things we did in that study was to try to get good data on the number of Americans that didn't have health insurance. That turned out to be terribly hard to do. And the estimate then was about 22 to 25 million Americans. Well, that was in our report, and we told people that, and they said, oh, you must have forgotten to count Medicaid, or you must have forgotten to count this and that. It was simply... nowadays, everybody knows that there's about 46, or whatever your favorite exact figure is, Americans without health insurance. At that point, people weren't aware of it and almost wouldn't believe it. There have been a whole history of failures to achieve national health insurance. Teddy Roosevelt, believe it or not, if you don't know this, was one of the first presidents to try to do so. But Truman did. Nixon, who's not the... probably the favorite president of bioethicists, but nevertheless, he tried too. And of course, Clinton tried in the beginning of the 90s, and they all failed. I used Obamacare at the bottom, but I don't use that as a derogative characterization of it. I was told the other day it was. But what it led to was piecemeal changes in the healthcare system. So, like the SCHIP. Plan. That improved, that put a lot more children, gave health insurance to a lot more children, but none of these piecemeal changes really dealt with the two main things that were being worked on, namely increasing or decreasing the number of Americans without health insurance. We never decreased it. The numbers have kept steadily rising. And dealing with the growth of healthcare costs, none of these changes have done much. There was a brief period in the 90s when managed care was popular before it became very unpopular. And when healthcare costs, the growth slowed. But they didn't really deal with these issues. Now, a sixth feature of this is what I've just called new technologies. New technologies, when they come along, raise issues about how they should be used. The Genome Project's a good example of that. And I have to think that the Genome Project and the Genome Institute at NIH really distorted bioethics during the early period, because there was a lot of money around at the Genome Institute, so people put in requests for grants for conferences, and I confess I got some funding for a book that I and some colleagues wrote, so I'm guilty here too, but it distorted, because there is in general isn't a lot of money available for research in bioethics. And the fact that there was a lot in the area of genomics led to a lot of probably and often not very good work. Stem cells, another example, neuroethics. There's just a public fascination with these new technologies when they come along, and in my view, it leads to excessive attention to them. So here are some generalizations about these past things. One is that the focus is on health care. Now, you'll see what that can be. You can guess what you can contrast that with, but if you can't, I'll tell you in 1 second. The focus is on interactions in a clinical context between patients and physicians, and in research context between researchers and subjects. And the focus in a lot of it over the years has been on what people often call ethical dilemmas. You know, should we breach confidentiality to warn this person about that this is a dangerous person, has an illness that's dangerous, and so forth, where the parties involved feel caught between competing and inconsistent or incompatible ethical concerns they have. In the example, confidentiality, but also protecting someone from being harmed by your patient. Now, what about my favorite of these, namely population-level bioethics? That's what a group of us have been working on at Harvard. Well, here are some features of it. There's a focus on health, not only health care. It's not to say that we should not worry about health care at all. But presumably the reason we worry about health care is because we think it has some impact on health. Otherwise, we wouldn't give it the worry we do. And health care accounts, for example, for only about a fifth of the longevity increases of the 20th century. So that certainly is one of the things that health care tries to do, too, is to increase longevity. If one is concerned with those longevity gains, and one ought to try to figure out what are the other things that have created them and how they've done so. Population-level bioethics creates issues mostly for societies as opposed to individual practitioners. And it focuses on facts both within groups but across groups, and that can mean across societies, not just within societies. It includes everyone, regardless of wealth and status, but it tends to emphasize the poorest because they're worst off with regard to health. They're worse off with regard to morbidity. They're worse off with regard to mortality in virtually all countries. And it includes all the determinants of health, including non-medical care things. Social class, race, ethnicity, environment, education, highway safety. Back around 2000, there was a report by a group called the Aitchison Report in England. It's spelled like Aitchison, but it's pronounced Aitchison, I learned. correction from my English friends. And what they looked at were policy issues that could have a significant impact on health. And they singled out 39 different issues, some of the traffic safety, various features of the social support system and so forth. 39 policy issues, none of them were about health care. They were about the wide range of social determinants, social factors that affect health. So if you start thinking about the population level issues, well, one central issue is going to be what inequalities across varying groups are justified. And key concepts would be things like equity, equality, and justice, measuring the burden of disease. That's what Chris Murray's group out at University of Washington is working on. Cost effectiveness, which is used a lot in resource prioritization and priority setting. Dan Wicker and I used the example of a bird's eye view. If you look down at societies from 35,000 feet, you can't see much about what's happening with this patient who's interacting with this physician. You're just too high up to see that. But you can see other things that you don't see if you just look at this physician and this patient. I'm going to give you a bunch of examples. But so if you think about equality in health, which is a central piece of this population level approach, equality among whom? Across classes, ethnic groups, urban, rural. I'll give you another example later of the urban and rural case. Certainly if you want to prioritize cost effective interventions, then rural patients just get screwed because it's cheaper to do it's cheaper to work in urban areas than it is in rural areas. Patients are concentrated more, and health infrastructure is almost certainly more in place in developing countries or developed countries, more in place in urban areas. I'll show you just later how that affected, for example, the 3x5 program to get 3 million people on antiretrovirals who were HIV positive later. If we're going to focus on equality, then we have to figure out how to measure it, and that turns out to be much more controversial and difficult to do than one might think at first. You may be able to take over measures from that economists use for measuring income inequality, like Gini coefficient, Atkinson measure. And one central issue, I think, is this contrast between equality and giving priority to the worse off. Is the goal to make everyone as equal as we can with regard to, for example, health status or health expectations, or to improve the worst off as much as possible? And I think in the philosophers who've been working on this stuff, prioritarianism seems to be winning out over egalitarianism. I'll give you the argument in the discussion, if any of you want it, as to why that's happening, I think. So there's one issue about which inequalities matter. How are we going to measure them? There's another about which inequalities don't matter. It's often thought that inequalities that flow from genetic differences are not unjust. That may or may not be true, but it's often thought that. It's often thought that inequalities across the sexes are not unjust and don't need to be corrected for. The women in this group, as a group, will live several years longer than the men in this group. And there is an issue in much health policy that is not assumed to be something that we need to do anything to correct for. Personal responsibility, if you're responsible for your health needs, does that affect how resources should be distributed, how payments for resources should be distributed? And that there are a lot of things that are thought of as just inequalities, just in comparison with unjust. It's typically thought that if people work harder in this country, it's typically thought that it's okay if they're better off than others. as a result of having worked harder, and we'll see that that can have implications and can usually be a responsibility. So at this population level, what are some of the ethical issues that arise from this perspective? And the rest of the talk I'm going to give you is about that. And to a significant extent, these are issues that haven't had anything like the attention from bioethicists that the clinical issues have. So what disciplines and methodologies are going to be needed to address these issues? Well, they're going to be different than, at least to some degree, those that people who have worked on clinical issues have drawn on. These issues will draw on the disciplines of demography, of gerontology, of genetics, of economic development, and other areas of economics. The central moral value that's going to be important here is social justice, and that shifts the focus from moral philosophy, from the personal morality to political philosophy. So if any of you are philosophers, you'll have to do different kinds of stuff than you would have done to participate in the clinical issues. So the rest of what I'm going to do is to just give you some examples. There are by no means all of them, but some examples of what I think are some of the issues that are important from this population level and that I hope some of you will work on. One is society's responsibility for the health of its citizens. In the 1980s and into the 90s, there was a so-called Washington Consensus forced on many poor countries to privatize their health care systems. And it was often forced on them by IMF and World Bank, whose resources these countries needed. China, in this period, not for the same reasons, but privatized much of their healthcare system, and then came to believe that that was a big mistake, and have had to be involved in rebuilding it, which they've made substantial progress in doing that. So partly it was just the Washington Consensus, which was mostly IMF and World Bank, but also these inexorable cost increases in health care have inevitably led to beachheads of private care in developed countries as well as in developing countries. That is, if it gets really expensive, then people with resources will want to have access to privatized health care that they can pay for but others can't. So one issue here is, what's the ethical case for the assumption of responsibility for health by the state? That's a hard question, I think. If there is some case, what form should that responsibility take? To what extent do we really need moral argument here to guide that issue, or do we just appeal to a political consensus that happens to exist in the country in question? Contrasting with social responsibility for health is personal responsibility for health. Poor health is often, as everybody here knows, I'm sure, is often the result of unhealthy behaviors, poor diet, lack of exercise, tobacco and substance abuse, failure to comply with medical advice. But what are the implications for health policy of this? When should it affect care, whether care is covered by the health service? In Great Britain, the public, as a result of there were surveys done to learn this, the public thought that, for example, port wine stains and other I'm not sure what the right word is. It's not a disability. Other unfortunate things like that should be covered by the healthcare system and the removal of them. On the other hand, when they were asked about tattoos, they thought, no, that shouldn't be covered by the National Health Service. Why? Because people weren't responsible for having port wine stains, but they were responsible for having tattoos. They made the choice. So there was an example where the public wanted to give significant weight to whether there was individual responsibility for the health need. And there are a lot of versions of this question. How might it affect the cost that individuals bear for their health care? Again, lots of insurance companies now charge higher premiums to people who smoke. And that's another aspect of this is that many unhealthy behaviors are concentrated in the poor, disproportionately so. Now, is this a result of personal failings? Some people think so. Or is this a result of social injustice? And we might think differently about our responsibilities to deal with it, depending on what we say about that. A more general issue here is that should these concepts of desert, of fault, of blame, and responsibility have a place in the health field? There's a strong norm in medicine that a physician's job is to treat healthcare needs, not to evaluate whether it's your own fault that you have those needs, whether you deserve care. There was a notion back in, at one point of the deserving poor, that was with regard to income, and the analogous notion that some people have is the deserving unhealthy, that is, you caused it yourself, and so don't think that the rest of us should have to pay for it. So there's issues about whether these notions of desert and so forth should have weight at the health policy level, but also at the clinical level. Certainly at the clinical level, physicians are not used to thinking about whether your job is to treat people's healthcare needs, your job is not to decide whether they deserve to be treated. Now, that's often difficult, especially for medical students. And they've spent the last month in the ER, and they have the patient that comes in for the 40th time this year to be dried out for his substance abuse. And they very much are inclined to react that there's got to be some limit on what you can claim of us just on grounds of need, because you're not doing anything to get rid of your need. Another issue here is bioethics and human rights. How many of you are from other countries besides this one? Few. In Europe, certainly, and I think in the developing world, and in institutions like UNESCO, WHO, and so forth, there's a lot of the work draws on a human rights tradition much more than it does in this country. And so the question is, is everyone doing the same thing, but they're just with sort of different ethical frameworks? I think it's unclear whether that is true. But to the extent that it is true, one might think about, wouldn't it be good to integrate work out of a human rights tradition with work out of a more philosophical tradition that bioethics in this country deals with. My department chair at Harvard is Paul Farmer, who does a lot of international work and is very, he's an example of people concerned with a lot of these issues and wanting to apply a human rights framework to it. And one of the things we would have to do is to see, well, which issues might the human rights framework be especially useful for, and which issues might it not be very useful for? I'm inclined to think of, for example, that with regard to the prioritization of research of resources, the human rights framework isn't terribly useful, but that remains to be shown. So how might we integrate the fields? Would it be useful to do so? A central issue here is priority setting. Scarce resources require priority setting for any of the healthcare services, drugs, services, priority setting between individuals or groups of patients, think of transplant candidates, for example. For interventions, priority setting in research. We don't spend enough money that we can have unlimited research programs for all the major needs. Should choices between treatment and prevention, for example, for HIV/AIDS, be based on cost effectiveness? Now, it turns out that recent research suggests that treatment may be the best prevention, in which case it helps with this issue. But if that isn't the case in some circumstances, is there special priority that should go to treatment when we could produce larger health benefits by prevention. I mentioned before the 3x5 program. That was a program, a WHO program, and the 10 years, almost 10 years ago, to treat patients with HIV/AIDS. And 3x5 referred to a goal of getting 3 million people on antiretrovirals by 2005. That was the goal of this program. On the other hand, they estimated at that time that there were 6 million people that could benefit from getting antiretrovirals. So even with a very ambitious goal, which they didn't come close to meeting, nevertheless, they could at best treat half the patients who could be benefited. But one of the issues that came up in one of the meetings that I was at WHO about this was one I've already mentioned, the rural versus urban patients. If you wanted to get as many patients as possible on antiretrovirals by that date, then you simply would not have gone into the rural areas and treated patients there. You would have gone to the urban areas, as I said, which had more healthcare infrastructure already in place. Patients were more densely together, and you could do it much more cost-effectively. So you get more patients. Now, some countries, WHO is probably, WHO can't tell a country what to do. What it can do is advise a country what to do. And so it was trying to provide advice as to how to carry out the 3x5 program. And there was a lot of resistance among a number of countries, I actually think for good reason, to simply saying, well, we go wherever we can get the most people on treatment, and we just use a cost-effectiveness standard. Because that gave people who were in rural areas, who were HIV positive, no chance at all to get what they needed. And so the way I would phrase the objection is that they might make is that we should have a fair chance. Question what a fair chance is, but we should have a fair chance to get our need, which is the same as the urban patients, our need met. We shouldn't simply have no chance at all because it's not as cost effective to treat us. That's an example of the kinds of issues that come up when one's thinking about priority setting. It's only one among many. Cost-effectiveness analysis tells you, if it's done correctly, tells you how to use limited resources, and resources are always limited, how to use limited resources to get the greatest health improvement for the population you're dealing with. Well, one of my favorite, this is a topic that I've been working on a lot over the last decade. The question is, what moral assumptions are embedded in cost-effectiveness analysis? And I would distinguish them of two sorts. There are some that are just embedded in how you do cost-effectiveness analysis. Economists, when they compare programs, always use discount rate for future benefits. And they think, I won't try to give their argument for that, but the discount rate essentially will make it the case that when you compare, for example, prevention programs where the benefit comes significantly into the future, then that discount rate will tell you that those future benefits are in fact less valuable than what look to be comparable present-day benefits. And so you'll end up if you apply a discount rate, you'll end up giving priority to the alternative that, in fact, has a smaller health gain. Now, this is widely debated by economists and by some philosophers, but it's clearly an ethical issue, not just an economic issue, because if it has those kinds of implications, which it does, then we ought to have some ethical case or defense of it. In particular, what does it do? A lot of prevention programs require a change in behavior now, which pays off at some point in the future, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, whatever. Some vaccine programs are like that. Well, if one uses a discount rate, then those prevention programs are always going to do worse, other things equal, than treatment programs, which produce the benefit, so to speak, right away. And this is one reason, although only one, I think, but one reason that prevention tends to be underfunded in comparison with treatment. So, and then there are issues in once you've done cost-effectiveness analyses, there's some interesting issues about how you use it in a priority setting. But since time is passing, I won't go into them. There are a couple of things one might do here. One might try to weight the values that you get from cost effectiveness by equity considerations. So you have equity weighted benefits, equity weighted qualities, for example. Or alternatively, and I think that's actually a non-starter. Alternatively, then one has to think about how can you help priority setters, health ministers in countries, who will get these cost-effectiveness analyses from the economists that they work with. They'll get them from WHO. How will you help them to integrate the equity concerns into the decision-making that they have to do? Because one standard way in which this is always, has often happened is, we give you the cost effectiveness analysis and the results of it, and then we say to the health ministers, well, of course, this doesn't take account of any concerns about equity. That's your job to do, and we don't tell them how to do it at all. And needless to say, then it doesn't get the weight that it might if they had some help with that. Health and economic development is another important issue from this population perspective. Jeff Sachs headed the WHO Commission on Macroeconomics and Health and argued in their report for health investments, not from their health benefit, but from their benefits in economic development, particularly in developing countries. So this implies that a country concerned with both health and economic development should take account of both of these kinds of benefits when they do resource prioritization. But this is in conflict with some fairly powerful norms in the health sector. It seems to imply that we should give different priority to investments that have equal health gains based on their different economic impacts. Well, we won't get the same economic impacts if we give the elderly the same priority as those who are in their working years, the disabled, the unproductive. So this is sharply in conflict with physicians' practices of ignoring the social value or worth, including the economic benefit of attending to patients. Instead, the official norm in medicine is to attend only to need, or need and combined with effectiveness in some way. So the question is, are these practices inconsistent? Is it okay to give weight to this at the macro level and to rule it out at the micro level and or the patient care level? And if so, what's the argument for doing what looks to be inconsistent? Environmental equity. Environmental risks are very unevenly distributed in this country and in any country. And what that means is that, what I've got in the second note here, the poor live near toxic waste dumps, polluted water, and so forth. The rich can avoid these. They both can and do. Now, it's also the case that the poor often don't benefit equally to the benefits of industrialization, which causes these health problems. So is this just another burden of being poor? I mean, too bad, you're poor, you don't have much money, and you're subject to health risks that the better off members of your society aren't subject to. Or is there some special moral reason to try to achieve a more equitable pattern of immunity from these threats to health? Bioethicists haven't attended very much to this, I think. Populations and genes. Historically, basically, the eugenics movement, and in particular the Nazi use of genetic goals, basically discredited any attention to this on a population level. That overstates it a bit, but I'm overstating everything today. eugenics has a bad name, right? That is big surprise. Now, but advances in genetics, as we now know, have given us new abilities to pursue the goal of a healthier population. Prenatal testing for disease, PGD, and so forth. Now, is there anything wrong with the goal of improving or increasing population health if one can separate it from the various things which made the Nazi programs, for example, state enforcement, abuse of persons in research? The question is something like this, I think. What lessons should we, in fact, take ourselves to have learned from the history of eugenics? Eugenics, it wasn't just the Nazis that did bad things in eugenics. There were big eugenic programs in a number of states in this country, big eugenic programs in Scandinavian countries, Sweden had them. So it's not just the bad guys, on the assumption that we're not the bad guys. So the issue is something like, what goals and values and standards and practices would we be talking about today if we didn't have this history to contend with? Because this history basically makes it very difficult for us to talk about this. Protecting health and endangering civil liberties, that's a standard public health concern. SARS and bioterrorism, only two of the most recent cases, threats to public health from infectious disease. Each of these caused a lot of public fear and panic, as well as a number of public policy responses. Many of those responses did, in fact, endanger civil liberties. So the question here that, as I say, public health is worried about a lot over the decades is, what sacrifices to civil liberties should be accepted to protect public health from these kinds of threats? Cuba has used quarantines to protect against the spread of HIV. There were quarantines used in China for SARS as well. And an interesting feature of this question, I think, is that we think about balancing public health and civil liberties. And the traditional issues have been where we have an epidemic, we think, needs to be responded to. But we don't think it's going to be around forever. Now, a lot of the threats are not limited duration epidemics of that sort, but relatively permanent threats like bioterrorism, or the threat of bioterrorism. And so the question is, one of the questions is, should the balancing between protecting civil liberties and protecting the population with these public health interventions, should that balance change when, in fact, the problems that we have to deal with are basically permanent problems? Global health inequities, I'm going to stop at 5:30, just wherever I am. Global health inequities, I mean, the morbidity and mortality differences across countries are extraordinary. So what's the nature of the injustice with regard to those differences? Is it only because we think that those differences come from have unjust causes? If you look at Africa, well, what do they have? They have colonialism and imperialism to deal with. They have unjust terms of trade to deal with, monopoly powers of global corporations. So you might think, well, all of those things are what make the inequalities unjust. But some of the disparities that exist don't arise from injustices of that sort, but from what we might be inclined to call natural causes of some sort. And then the question is, are they still unjust? Even within countries like this one, if you look across counties in this country, the inequalities in both morbidity and mortality are much bigger than people tend to believe they are. And so are these inequalities unjust? Many people in public health contexts tend to talk about if they find an inequality, they also label it an inequity. That is, that any inequality is unjust. But in fact, most of us don't believe that. We believe at least that, you know, somebody works really hard, then it's not unjust that they're better off than somebody who doesn't work really hard. And there, of course, again, are the issues of what measures we should use to measure these inequalities. One next to last point. Jeffrey Rose did a very interesting paper some couple of decades ago comparing what he called medical versus population responses to risk factors. The medical response was to identify high-risk individuals and then to treat them. Population response, and this again oversimplifies a bit, but population response was to reduce the risk in the population as a whole, and usually by non-individual and non-medical interventions. So it would be, you know, physician tests people for high blood pressure or high cholesterol and tries to identify who's especially at risk because of that. The population group does what Bloomberg's trying to do in New York, get salt out of anything that's sold, get less sugar sold, and that affects the whole population. Now, sometimes these are just complementary and one can do them both, but given scarce resources, one still has to figure out how to balance them. And the question is, are there any other ethical factors besides effectiveness and cost? And the medical approach might seem more respectful of choice because it tells the patient, you're at high risk. We can do this to change that risk, but you'll have to cooperate on it. You'll have to take your meds or do whatever else is involved. The population approach imposes the interventions on everybody, whether they're highly at risk or not. So the population approach might be more equitable, though, by reducing risks equally in everyone. If you get the sodas not sold in any schools, then you affect the whole population relatively equally. Said a little bit about this already, I want to say this before I stop. I want to come back and just make this comparison again between the earlier clinically focused bioethics and this population focus. The population level bioethics draws on, I tried to illustrate this, different intellectual resources. Within ethical theory, the primary resource is social and political philosophy, whereas the clinical ethics draws on personal morality. I shouldn't lie to you, I should keep my promises to you, and so forth. So questions of individual conduct and character are secondary here. It's not they have no place. Quantitative training is very important for doing this kind of work. So statistics, economics, in particular health economics. Anyone who wants to do this should learn some health economics. Probably should anyway, but and that should be part of the training of people who are going to do this kind of work. Population-level bioethics directs our attention to a different set of controversies and a different set of unsolved problems. And I've given you some examples. There are more that I haven't had time to. How do we compare and rank distributions, for example, of health prospects across a population in order of inequity? And that simply is not at all clear. Larry Temkin, some of you philosophers, Larry Temkin has a book on inequality. He has 12 different respects in which you can measure and compare inequalities. And finally, population-level bioethics speaks to different audiences. It speaks mostly to people who have responsibility for population-level decisions, less often to individual patients and individual clinicians. It also has different academic neighbors, I've already said this, but has a substantial overlap with economics, the priority setting in particular. Other neighbors, demography, history, sociology, political science, decision analysis, decision theory, and it's international and global almost inevitably. So, the conclusion, I hope some of you, especially the younger of you, I'm probably the oldest guy in the room, hopefully some of you particularly just entering the field, will decide to work on some of these population issues that have very big impacts on health and health inequalities, impacts that I think bioethicists haven't paid enough attention to. Thank you.
Dan can field questions, just hands up.
Dan can try to field. Yes.
So, it's like you're envisioning a major shift in bioethics away from clinical ethics, which has been moving away from for quite a while. So that, is it going to be philosophy based at all?
Well, I should say that I've obviously been giving a plug for this population level approach, but I think it should be added to what bioethics does. It isn't that we should forget about the clinical issues or the research issues that take place between researcher and subject. I once gave a talk called Broadening the Bioethics Agenda, and that's what I have in mind here too. That is that we should take on these other issues, and they are different, but we shouldn't give up doing the clinical stuff, and many bioethicists will just do the clinical stuff. I think, frankly, I think you have to know more to do the population stuff, because you need all the health economics, you need understanding about how institutional change takes place and so forth, whereas it's a little easier to think, should I lie to this patient? So much of the work in bioethics will continue to be clinically focused. So I don't want to get rid of what we have been doing. I just want to add more attention to these issues. Yes, sir.
Dan, it seems to me that your assumption that economics is a value overlooks the very issues that you raised earlier with cost-effectiveness analysis. That's, I don't know a form of economic analysis that doesn't embed in its assumptions a theory of society, a theory of equity, and can be separated from them. That is, you know, once you assume a market, you've already made certain assumptions about rationality, behavior, choice, distribution, allocation that are inevitably political. And there isn't any political economics that I know of.
I spent the last 10 years of my life, besides when I go to art museums or read novels, when I'm working on doing my work, on issues about cost effectiveness and the moral assumptions that are embedded in it, both in when you do a cost-effectiveness analysis and then if you try to use the results of it for resource prioritization. So I agree with you. On the other hand, done well, it can give us sometimes useful information. It's not information that answers the resource prioritization question, but it's something that we may want to know. Now, I sort of know what you want to say. Go ahead.
I just want to say that done well is a big charismatic assumption, because done well in any discipline is much rarer than done.
I couldn't agree more, and I'm afraid that I think that's definitely true of bioethics. Our new provost at Harvard is Alan Garber, who does do this stuff well.
I'm not denying that it can't be done well. I'm just saying that I've all of a sudden become an implementation of the scientist. And what I'm aware of is
everybody's becoming that.
But what I'm aware of is that nobody trusts the level. Nobody trusts data at the organizational level that they're reporting. Nobody actually believes their own data. But somehow they believe that if we aggregate 100 bad sources of institutional data, that we'll have one good source of data. And it's sort of confusing.
What a meta-analysis.
It's my wife now.
No, but I'm sympathetic. I'm sympathetic to your question or statement, whatever. But I learned it once when I was in the Soviet Union, and I gave a lecture, and then so they had a brief question period, and then they had a very long statement period where people could just say what they wanted. I didn't have to connect it to what you did or whatever. But no, I'm very sympathetic to what you say, but I think done well, it does tell us something significant, which is if all we wanted to do was to maximize health benefits with the resources that we have available, then done well, it can help us answer that question. That isn't all we want to do with the resources available, and so we have to figure out how to take account of those other concerns that we have. And there's a whole host of them. I did a paper about 10 years ago, which was called, I could send it down to you, but it was called Ethical Issues in the Use of Cost-Effectiveness Analysis for Resource Prioritization, and trying to, it was sort of an agenda-setting paper, not for anyone else, just for me, about what I would be working on. And the point was to try to articulate all the things that even good cost effectiveness leaves out or doesn't take account of. And the economists have a lot of influence in a lot of settings with their cost effectiveness analyses. WHO has a big program on providing cost effectiveness analyses for particular developing countries, but not just developing countries. And so it seems to me what bioethicists who want to work in this area should do is at least try to make people who want to use these analyses a little more sophisticated about what they leave out and how they could take account of these other considerations. Yes, sir.
I'm really interested in the health economy stuff you were talking about. Which healthcare economists do you personally really admire and why? Just like briefly, because I'm just following up in more areas later.
Well, if this was at Harvard, I wouldn't say this. Because it would be thinking that I'm just sucking up. But I do admire Alan Garber's work. He just became our new provost. He's a health economist. He's both a physician and an economist. There's a number of there's some in Norway. I've gotten to the age where remembering names is horrible, but there are some in Norway that I admire. Ulrich Norheim. There's a journal that's very good on this, which is called Economics and Philosophy, and it publishes a lot of good stuff. The best group of health economists is, I think, still at York University in Great Britain. That's where Alan Williams used to be. He was one of the leaders in that field. They publish, there's two journals called Health Economics. One is published at Harvard. Joe Newhouse is editor of that. I actually like the other journal that's published at York. It's called Health Economics because it is... It publishes more of the stuff that I find interesting to read. As I say, Alan Williams was one of the... He was head of the group at York. I'm just not remembering. But if you look through those journals, you'll see the kind of stuff. Eric Nord is another from Norway, but whose work I admire a lot, and who's very attentive to the ethical issues of cost-effectiveness, largely ignores. Yeah.
I think I speak for many of us in saying I'm very happy you gave this talk. It's been a wonderful agenda-stretching talk. Just wanted to add one suggestion, because both population, I started in demography, both population-level work and economic work
tends not to look at institutional power. And it's really important to take on the issues of power and the powerless. I think Paul Farmer's book, Pathologies of Power, you know, really puts the issues several times very succinctly. And that tends, I just recommend adding that dimension.
I think you're right. I'm not sure I'm going to write this paper again, because it's I would simply agree with you on Paul's book, Pathologies of Power, is a good book. Paul is he really hates cost-effectiveness analysis for one good reason and one less good reason. One reason is he thinks it's just an excuse that policymakers give for not doing things they ought to do because they say, well, it's not cost-effective to do them. And to a significant extent, that's right. Actually, both the reasons are perfectly good reasons. That's a good reason. But the other thing is that a lot of it assumes that resources, the amount of resources we have, are relatively fixed. And Paul is a wonderful example of why that's wrong. He, Partners in Health, which he founded with Jim Kim, now has a budget of over $80 million, an annual budget of over $80 million. Paul has been extraordinary at being able to raise money for a variety of efforts that when he first went into Haiti, people thought, well, you couldn't do the kind of work that needed to be done to treat HIV/AIDS in the rural, very poor areas of Haiti. And he showed that that was false, that you could do it. And that led to it being done in a lot of other countries as well. So what he would say is, look, one of the things that's wrong with cost-effectiveness analysis is it assumes a fixed level of resources, and that level of resources isn't fixed, because I can go out, and I have gone out, and get lots more resources for doing some of these things. So he's right about both those things. Okay. Time for drinks.
If I could pick up on John's last point, which is that economics itself, institutional economics, has disappeared from economics in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And economics now is more, is happening at the bird's eye view that you're talking about, and less involved.
Probably way above that bird's eye.
And less involved at the way things get negotiated on the ground. So, there is a danger that the slippage between the models and practice.
Oh, absolutely.
Is not going to get paid better attention.
All the work in behavioral economics is a way of trying to take account of what happens when people are actually engaged in these transactions, and I find the stuff in behavioral economics really quite fascinating, but it hasn't. Well, it's been integrated to a significant extent.
Yeah, it's usually though at the individual or dyad or triad level. Again, it's behavioral economics didn't discover economic sociology; they bypassed economic sociology, which is a burgeoning, powerful field, and aligned with psychologists, experimental social psychologists, to do studies of one, two, or three people in various kinds of set up experiments. And so it's fine, but the thing is, again, institutions in power that are addressed by people who study organizations and institutions tends to get left out when you have population and behavior.
Right. Although
all the power structures in between are not discussed because it's considered
polite. I agree with you, but I'm a great admirer of Danny Kahneman's work, and it was a new book. It says something that someone can get a Nobel Prize in economics who never took an economics course. He told me that. So he didn't get, I guess, spoiled by having taken one. But, I agree with you. Okay. Thank you.
Nice to see you.